Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. The Missouri State Legislature has an opportunity to pass laws that will make our life better or worse. Sometimes they pass laws that make a huge difference and things come out well. Sometimes they pass laws that do nothing but give them bragging rights for the next time an election comes up. So let's talk for a moment. There is an amendment coming on your ballot. If you live in the state of Missouri, August 5th is going to be 2 weeks from today. You'll have an opportunity to vote on this. Well, what is the gun amendment and why did they put it on the ballot? Let's give you a little background here. Some people think it's called the Second Amendment Preservation Act, which did get some publicity. But let me explain the difference to you. The Second Amendment Preservation Act went into state statute. It was designed to respond to the federal government's overreaching and infringement on our rights. It was also designed to give our state a set of tools, including the nullification provision for our rights. So it was pretty much, you can sum it up as being an anti-commandeering act. It would have made it illegal for our sheriffs to cooperate with the federal government. It was really more about the 10th Amendment than the Second Amendment. And once we learn what the 10th Amendment is all about, that states have the right to define ourselves, and all laws are up to the states unless expressly mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. Now, what we have this year on the ballot, not to be confused, it is not a Second Amendment Preservation Act. This is something totally different. This is a Court Restriction Act. It is a declaration to the courts that they must be contained. I hope that makes it easy for you tonight. I'm excited about all legislation that contains courts and contains the federal government. So both would have been good, but let me tell you, the legislative process is a rocky road, and not to be minimalized, there are things that can happen. A good bill can suddenly become bad, and a bad bill can suddenly become good. Well, no, I don't think I've ever seen that happen, but it's possible. Let's talk about what is then on the ballot. Changes the Constitution. That's why it needed to go on the ballot. We can change our own laws in the legislature in Jefferson City without a vote of the people, without the people's knowledge, without the people's consent. That's what legislatures do all the time. That's why people are unhappy when they know the legislature is in session and can take away their rights, and when they do take away your rights, that is an unpleasant moment. Now, here we have today, fast forward, this bill that's coming up on your amendment in August, it's going to change the Constitution. The legislative branch of government cannot change your Constitution. Only you can change your Constitution. I'm so glad I get to live in a state where we have at least some protections. When we put things in the Constitution, it's like putting the glassware and the fragiles up high so that they're out of reach of the baby who's going to come over for a visit. So it is possible for a baby to get up on a ladder and grab the valuables off the high shelf, but not as likely. We ought to always take it very seriously when we're altering our Constitution. The Constitution is a statement of our values and what we hold dear. Those are our ideals. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is in the Constitution already under Section 23 of our Missouri Bill of Rights. So just like there's a Bill of Rights for the federal government, there also is a Bill of Rights for state government. So Section 23, the law currently reads, and let me read the preamble so you get it all together. The preamble to the Missouri Constitution says, "We the people of Missouri, with profound reverence for the supreme ruler of the universe and grateful for his goodness, do establish this Constitution for the better government of the state." As soon as you're done with the preamble, it goes right into the Missouri Bill of Rights, which also has a preamble. It says, "In order to assert our rights, acknowledge our duties, and proclaim the principles on which our government is founded, we declare." And now we have all these declarations, and you get up to Section 23, we declare that the right of every citizen to keep and bear arms in defense of his home, person, and property, or when lawfully summoned in aid of the civil power, shall not be questioned. How exquisite is that? But they added one more phrase, "but this shall not justify the wearing of concealed weapons." There's a story behind that too, folks. We're going to get to that story. But right now, let's take a look at what this amendment is going, the new proposed amendment is going to do for us. You look at the, and you can find this, first of all, if you get my newsletter, you'll find that very enriching. Please sign up for my newsletter. You'll get an infusion of truth and honesty and what's really happening in Missouri. When you're done reading the newsletter, there are links to our Blog Talk Radio. And the Ballotpedia language that's being proposed says this. We're leaving in every citizen will keep, has the right to keep and bear arms, but we're adding and ammunition and accessories typical to the normal function of such arms in defense of his home, person, family, property, or when lawfully summoned in aid of civil power shall not be questioned. And then the phrase is removed, but this shall not justify the wearing of concealed weapons, because that's already been addressed in. Then the new section comes in. The rights guaranteed by this section shall be unalienable. Any restriction on these rights shall be subject to strict scrutiny, and the state of Missouri shall be obligated to uphold these rights and shall under no circumstances decline to protect against their infringement. Nothing in this section shall be construed to prevent the General Assembly from enacting general laws which limit the rights of convicted felons, violent felons, or those duly adjudged mentally infirm by a court of competent jurisdiction. So there you have it, folks. We have one exquisite amendment going on to the ballot. Well, it looks like we might have a caller tonight. I welcome you. Who is on the line? Go ahead, caller.
Hello, Cynthia. Cynthia,
hi.
Karen.
What an absolute thrill. What a thrill and delight. Karen, do you have...
I had to hear what you were saying about that.
Well, thank you. Do you have an opinion about legislation pertaining to our Second Amendment?
Well, I just wonder why we need it. Shouldn't it be obvious to state legislatures and to the people in general what are just simply based on the Second Amendment reading?
It should be obvious, but hey, Karen, how many times have you ever looked at a bill or a piece of legislation and said that should be obvious and then discovered that maybe what's obvious to us is not obvious to other people? So we go over.
True.
Here we have governments wanting to make more laws all the time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a gun, and what are your feelings about your right to own a gun?
Yes, I own firearms, plural, and I think that I was raised in a hunting and firearm society, I guess you could call it that, and we were safe with them. We did not use them in any dangerous manner. We did know of at least one person who had an accidental shooting. Those things are not any greater risk than driving in your car and having an accident. So for me, I see it as both an issue of self-protection and occasionally an issue of food. I don't think there's any problem with people owning firearms. I think the problem comes in when criminals have them and the average citizen does not.
And I would agree with that, because many people like the idea of having guns for their own safety and protection. I certainly think that is way more important than anything else, because once somebody hurts you, the damage is done. My question is, if you live in a more urban area, there are a lot of people who have an intense fear about what if somebody deranged should get a gun. What if we make it so easy for people to get guns that some scary, awful people end up with them and they shoot us all? How do you explain that one? And that's where this language says, it talks about convicted violent felons and those who are considered mentally infirmed, but they shouldn't be able to get guns. Well, you know what? There probably have been people with evil in their heart and mentally infirmed people who actually have gotten a hold of guns before. How do you make sense out of public policy when you have people who you have a interest in government in protecting the innocent?
Well, protecting the innocent, you can only protect the innocent so far no matter what you do. And no matter what it is, it can be you could ban everyone from driving and make everyone walk, and someone's going to trip in a pothole anyway. Or you could ban everyone that you think might be potentially harmful from having a firearm, and somebody's going to get one and use it anyway. So I think that, I mean, I grew up in a state in California where even as a child there were registration and people who were felons or people who had mental health issues that were known, they were not allowed to have firearms because everyone had to sign up for that. Personally, I don't think that we should, I mean, I don't think our society should be that bad that we would need to constantly register everyone all the time. I think there's a sense of responsibility from people who know people who have mental issues to try and prevent them from getting a hold of them. But as we saw in the case of Jonesboro in Arkansas, those two little boys that got those firearms and went into their junior high school and started shooting broke into a safe. So even if a firearm is secure and kept out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, or who children who may not be responsible, adults who may be criminals, if they really are intent on getting them, the only way to prevent that is to ban firearms from the entire planet, and that didn't stop Cain from using a rock.
And the...
So...
Right, the fast and furious people who were drug smugglers and gang members, they don't seem to have a problem with getting a hold of guns. And so you could perhaps argue that you'd have to be mentally off balance to shoot another human being. Now we've got a population of veterans who are coming home from the Middle East who may have had post-traumatic stress syndrome. How do you decide that somebody may be, now we all declare because he's suffered from a mental illness, that he should never be able to have a gun again? What if they get better? It says right here in this amendment, if they've been adjudicated in a court of law to be mentally incompetent, does that mean that is that a lifetime ban? How do you know what is right and fair? What if that mentally ill veteran was in the corner when some bad guy broke into your house and saved your life? I don't know how we can be intelligent about this, but ultimately there is a limit on what government can and cannot do. There is always going to be, like you said, bad things that happen. So what I'd like to know is, do you have any history on when guns had to be registered? Certainly anybody who's watched the John Wayne movies and Tonto and the Lone Ranger and all the great cowboys and westerns and the wagon trains, people didn't need to register guns back then. Do you, Karen, have any history for us about what caused that and what the positive effects have been from that?
No, I don't have any dates or any states to give you, you know, law on that or any information on that. I just was reminded, though, when you were talking about the John Wayne movies and all, I do believe Wyatt Earp and a few other sheriffs kind of had their own gun control. Basically, if you come into Dodge, you better leave your weapons at the sheriff's office. That seemed to work pretty well, actually. But no one was banned from having guns. They just temporarily couldn't carry them in town when they were drunk.
No. Well,
Of gun control there.
Yes. I have enjoyed, I don't like movies that are real scary, but I can vouch for the fact that all the guys on F Troop did not have guns. I mean, they didn't have to register their guns to have them. Nobody got killed on F Troop. There were a few close calls. So, Karen, let me ask you, what inspired you to want to get a gun? Why not just call 911? Or why not just, if you have a snake come in your house, why not just get a hatchet or a shovel?
It's much easier to get one with a gun that's, you know, with snake shot in it than it is to use a hatchet. one thing. But... You know, for another thing, I grew up with them. It isn't like I haven't always had one. But, you know, as long as I can remember, from the time I was about 8 and shooting a 410 until, you know, today when I have something other than that, then it's just always been there. And it's always been in our house as a defense. And, like I said, we would sometimes go hunting and eat the meat. But it's not ever been anything not normal. It's always been normal.
Karen,
don't perceive gun ownership as abnormal behavior.
If you were the president of the United States of America and you could issue an edict to all the citizens and ask the states to comply, what would you adopt as a public policy that would make us safer in regards to how we handle our state-to-state gun laws?
You're talking about interstate transport of firearms or ammunition or?
Well, what is the single problem that people are trying to fix? You know the old expression, if it isn't broken, don't fix it? So every year, every state seems to come up with ideas on how we can change our gun laws, and they're trying to fix something that appears to be the wrong tool for the job. We have not gotten to the heart of what's causing violence between people. We have still not gotten in touch with what's wrong with or what's prompting people to behave in a mean-spirited way toward each other. I don't think that as much as we try and craft new laws, we're going to get it. Missouri just lowered its age when you could get a concealed weapon from 23 down to, I think this year they made it 19. And I still look at this and say, what is that going to solve? Is that feel-good legislation, or is it actually going to make the world a better place? How do we rightly come up with public policy that is steer us in the right direction? Karen, take us home.
Okay. There is no way that you can legislate morality, and morality is the problem. People have lost a sense of neighborhood, a sense of value of other life. There is a lot of serious problems out there, and they're not going to fix it by gun laws. A firearm is just a tool in the hand of a person, just every bit as much as your fork or your spoon or a drill or any other tool that you would use. And it's the mind of the person that controls the tool. We cannot legislate safety that way.
I'm not sure if you've seen the sign that says "Welcome to Wisconsin," but you can Google it. It's hilarious. It says "Welcome to Wisconsin. Attention, criminals and terrorists." Over 170,000 Wisconsin residents have a legal permit to carry a handgun. They are armed and prepared to defend themselves and others against acts of criminal violence. You have been warned. Illinois and Chicago, however, have been disarmed for your convenience. That's it.
Well, it reminds me of a statistic I saw the other day, and that was that 88.8% of Americans are believed to own some sort of firearm. And I've also heard it said that the reason that America has never been invaded by an armed force, although there have been a few attempts, is because they can't be sure who's not armed. There could be an American with a rifle behind every tree in the Northwest or in the East or in the Southwest, although maybe sagebrush down in the Southwest. But they can't predict that. And they can't predict the American mind that they're not going to defend themselves with these firearms. So just the very fact that we have them and that it is thought that so many people have them has been a protection for our nation in a way that we might not normally consider.
Well, it's personal responsibility at its core, which is one of the values. You either trust government to save you, which means if you have a problem, you call 911 and wait for a police officer to come, or you can find a way to protect yourself until the officer gets there. And until we can get a grip on what it means to take personal responsibility, I think we're losing that value in this country. I believe when I've even seen the Department of Social Services act in intervening in family relationships, you've seen government take children out of homes. And the amazing part is that in some of the worst home situations, they tend to leave the kids there, but in some of the best home situations, they'll wrench the kids out of there real quick. And where is that responsibility? Where is it the place for neighbors to come to the aid of neighbors and for family members to engage with their families and say, no, you're my offspring. I will step in and we will make it right. We do not need the government to define our family. We are our family, and this is the biggest problem with divorce, that a lot of people lose control of their children because they're turning the courts over to make decisions on who gets custody, when they can visit, and those were decisions that they used to be able to make. They had freedom to make those decisions. When you ask government to step in, you're giving away a portion of your freedom. I would like us to talk for a minute about how do we regain freedom in a culture where people seem to be wanting government to grow bigger all the time. Do you have some thoughts for us, Karen?
Well, I've thought about this quite a bit lately, and I think that it begins with us first as individuals. And first, we have to take responsibility for ourselves and not turn to government for everything. We need to have our personal supplies of it ready in an emergency situation so that we don't need to call in FEMA or go to the Red Cross unless, you know, there are extreme emergencies that we can't predict. But we should be prepared for whatever it is that we can. We should be prepared by educating ourselves, by being gainfully employed if possible. And if not, then if there's a problem with unemployment, then we turn first to our family, then to our community and our churches, and then beyond that. But initially, it starts with ourselves. Secondly, we teach our families, we teach our children how to be self-reliant and be on their own two feet and not rely on us, which is a big problem in our society right now where they rely too much. Children can rely too much on the parents still, and so there has to be a balance of when you step in and when you don't, because they have to develop their individual reliance as well. Secondly, your family, and then thirdly, you branch out to your community and your church, and fourth would be your county and your state level, and fifth, federal. We've got it all backwards. We've got the pyramid upside down when we talk about government. We usually, when we talk about government, we put a pyramid with federal at the top and the people at the bottom, and we need to flip that around and put the people at the top as the most important thing. And even the Constitution itself starts out with Article 1 for the people. It talks about the House of Representatives before it does anything else. And so the people first, our individual self, our relationship to man, from man to God, all of those relationships need to be in the right order, and then the rest of it falls. And the very, very last thing, and even individuals shouldn't have to go to the federal government. The state, they should be able to go to their state, and if the state then decides we need more help from our fellow states, then we go to the federal government. Instead, we want to jump the other way and just go straight up.
You know, families used to take pride in taking care of their own. It used to be an act of despair for anybody to acknowledge, I guess I'm going to have to ask the government to help me. And that is all turned upside down. Now people want to go to government first because they figure, why should my parents have to pay for this, or why should my children have to pay for this? Yet that's given with love when we do it for each other. So as government grows bigger, we're seeing a huge increase in state budgets, and a lot of states are really struggling now to come up with how they can fix things. I had a constituent who wrote me recently a very humorous letter. We were trying to solve the problems of all the state governments and their overspending, and as demand goes up, the states want to provide more, and we're moving towards socialism as we do that. I was studying what's going on in Washington State, and it's always funny to read about other states that are in distress because of mismanagement, overspending, bloating the budget. So there was this fun little tool I came across that allows you to see what you would cut to balance the budget. I was talking with this person about how we're going to fix this, and he said that what we could do is, let me say, first of all, in Missouri, we have a constitutional amendment that says we're going to spend no less than 25% of our state budget on public education. Now, that to me sounds like a big number, and it seems kind of irresponsible to carte blanche just assume we'll always want to spend 25%, but nevertheless, because we've established that standard, that's what it has to be. So here's what my constituent wrote. He said in Washington, it says the legislature shall provide for a general and uniform system of public schools, but it never puts a dollar amount on it. The Constitution doesn't say what has to be taught or how new or big the school building has to be or whether we have to provide buses for the kids to get there, or that the schools need to have facilities for arts or sports. As I see it, we'd be constitutional if we rented an old shopping center or warehouse, told the parents to get the kids there themselves if they want an education, and then just teach reading, math, writing, and send them home by noon so the teachers can instruct the second batch in the afternoon. I bet we could cut the education budget by 50% and still produce kids better fit for the workforce. Anyway, this makes me laugh because I remember when we had a bus strike in our area, and it was actually the best thing that could have happened because it made the parents take responsibility for their kids. There was a proposal in the legislature while I was there that allowed us to have the four-day school week if some rural districts wanted to do that. And they could save 20% on their transportation fees, if you think about it, by having school 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week. You just shave 20% off of the time transporting the kids to and from, not to mention all the monkey business that goes on the buses. The biggest pushback for that ended up being that people have used the schools for daycare. Not education, but babysitting. And that is always the bottom line of the debate. I don't understand why we're more why we aren't more angry at the diminishment of our public schools by making them into glorified daycare centers instead of actually using them for the pure purpose of educating the students. I don't know where it
ends.
I once lived
in a situation where winter was quite dangerous, and I'm sure it is in Missouri too. But the bus would stop in front of my house, and there were ditches on either side. And I kind of had to drive up a hill and kind of in the winter and kind of turn left or right really fast and hope I didn't slide off to the other side. And the school bus would slow, and I'd seen them slide several times, you know, just trying to stop in front of the house. And I asked the school district one day, I said, how come you don't have more snow days, especially when the ice is so bad that, you know, I mean, you're worried about power lines coming down? And they said, well, you know, we just have so many children that wouldn't have any heat in their homes, and they wouldn't have anyone home to help them stay warm. And I'm thinking, I use a wood stove, and most people are using electricity. I really don't know how this is, you know, how come people can't take care of their own children, and they have to send the children to school to be warm on snow days, on dangerous roads with lots of dangerous ice, rather than, isn't it not more in the child's self, or, you know, to keep them safe, you know, everybody's worried about that, keep them home and let their parents keep them warm and safe, you know, on those kind of bad days when nobody should be out on the roads. And his answer was simply because we get federal funds. We get federal funds for each child, full-time equivalency, the hours, and so, and we worry, and we also worry that the children would be home alone. And again, it comes back to the idea of who's in charge. If you're waiting for federal funds, And that's why you want your school to be open even when it's dangerous out there. What was the priority?
Right. And where are the, what have we done to ourselves as human beings? Why are we not
we put
taking
the money? The money takes priority.
Mm-hmm. And again, government is reacting to the pathology of society. Instead of expecting us to be better people, be bigger people, be stronger people, we are Americans. I want somebody to start humming some America the Beautiful in the background while we talk, because that is the essence of us being American, that we aren't the pansies they have over in other countries where they're waiting for government to spoon feed them, that we're strong, we're brave, we're self-sufficient, and we get our courage from our moral fiber. I believe that if you could see a bar graph right now, let's make it a line graph, just imagine it in your head. As our morality has declined, our courage has declined, our love for neighbor has declined, we are watching things go sour. But not to depress anybody, we can get it back again. We can be bigger than this. We can be better than this. We can take it back anytime we want, one family at a time. So, Karen, tell me what it's like in Alaska.
Well, Karen was about to say that in the interest of self-reliance, she has to go to work now. Because I do have to hang up. But anyway,
Have you felt a different tone in another state moving where people have...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I've lived in lots of states. I've lived in Virginia, Colorado, California, Washington, Idaho. And up here in Alaska right now, there's, you know, people, it's an open carry state. You go anywhere and pretty much you feel safe. People walk with firearms. You're not worried about it. You're more worried about if they don't have one because, you know, there's bear right here in the neighborhood or moose walk down the street, you know. So it's like sometimes you just need to have something. And not to mention that there are some unpredictable people around. So there's a lot more freedom. You just feel it, a lot more freedom. People literally dress any way that they want to dress without any worrying about what anyone else thinks. The spirit of liberty is very strong up here.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
I've lived in Los Angeles or wherever, you know, in the cities where I've lived. So
that's exciting. Well, thank you for sharing that story with us. Karen, thank you for being with us tonight. You are a blessing and a delight, and I wish you well. Go out there and protect yourself.
Okay. Thank you, Cynthia. And I'll be looking forward to listening to this later on.
Okay. We'll
talk
all
to you later.
Take care. Thank you, Karen. Appreciate you being with us.
Bye.
Thank all of you. It's good. It's important. What we're doing is valuable. Be brave. Stay tough. And let's see a good end. Stay constitutional.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.